Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Listening to your podcast has really helped me in letting go of that shame and knowing that I'm not alone. It truly does happen to all people from all different walks of life, all different careers, all socioeconomic statuses, races, like geographical locations, everything.
The When Dating Hurts podcast is rated one of the most popular relationships podcasts in the world. Why is that? It's our guests. Whether you're listening to subject matter experts or domestic violence survivors, you know you're hearing what you need to know, and that is the truth about dating and domestic violence. Why it happens, how it happens, when it happens, where it happens, and how victims become survivors. This podcast is a powerful way for you, your friends, and your family to stay informed and stay safe. Every survivor story has its merits. This one is no exception. Listeners might tire of me saying you should be sure to hear both episodes of a story, but I promise this is the case here. For those thinking domestic violence doesn't happen to people like you, Jamie's narrative is evidence to the contrary. A college graduate, a law school graduate, a prosecutor in the Philadelphia area, and yet a domestic violence victim. Listeners, this can happen to anyone. Here's my interview with Jamie. Today we're speaking with Jamie. Her story should be absolutely amazingly interesting and complex. Very happy that she sent me an email and wanted to talk about coming on the podcast. And so we have the honor of speaking with you today, Jamie. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me. And I want to say it means a lot. The work that you do and your podcast has really helped me on my healing journey.
I appreciate you saying that. Obviously, one of the things that attracted me so much to getting in touch with you was that with those things that were happening in your life when you met Adam, you would be probably under the heading of people least likely to have these type of things happen. And the fact that it's affected you so much for years, that also is one of those things, because there are stereotypes about people who are abused, people who wind up in these relationships, these unhealthy relationships. But for our audience and for me, give us a sense of growing up and what that looked like, you know, family and how life felt back then.
So I grew up in a loving home. Both my parents were present, very supportive and encouraging of myself and my older brother. Things were good growing up. You know, they always said I could do whatever I want and I should do that. And I actually decided in high school that I wanted to be a prosecutor, which I think is a little rare to know that young.
What was the thing that ran through your head? I mean, I can't think of a whole lot of girls growing up, if I could say that, who think, you know, I don't know what they would think. You know, they might want to be in business, or they want to, let's say, healthcare or something like that, or maybe even police work. But to jump all the way to prosecutor, I picture somebody who is going through a lot of evidence and talking with people who are victims and trying to get the bad people where they belong, let's hope. That's a leap.
It was when I was in high school and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was good at public speaking. You know, my dad said, you should be a lawyer. Just, you know, he just kind of said that. And I was like, okay. But, you know, Law and Order was on television and I always watched it, enjoyed it. And my parents really instilled in me a sense of accountability.
Yeah, that's great.
To be held accountable for their actions. And I thought, this is something I could do to help people. And so that's kind of where it started.
So you go through high school, then what do you do?
I graduate from high school. I'm going to go to college. It's such a big time in people's lives. And I, all of this is probably is difficult to talk about because I've never done that. I've never kind of just went through it and told my whole story. But I feel like it's important in doing, you know, I've done a lot of trauma therapy recently, actually. And I think it's important also for the people listening to kind of understand and potentially, you know, to be helpful in their own journeys. I actually, you know, graduated high school and that summer I went away on a trip with my friends.
Where'd you go?
We went to North Carolina.
Okay. This is from Pennsylvania.
Yes. It was the first time we were going away at, you know, we're 18 thinking we're adults, drinking and, you know, all of that. I was raped. And
I mean, what were the circumstances? I mean, that's quite a leap to say, went to North Carolina with my friends. What was happening? You know, where were you? Or, I mean, I can't imagine just walking down the street or what are you doing?
You know, we had rented a house. It was me and like eight other girls. We were drinking and we were just, you know, hanging out at the beach for the week. Some of my friends had met some guys at some point during this, told them where we were staying, and they showed up one night. You know, you're just drinking. It's a party, not thinking anything of anything. I certainly never could have imagined, but I was drinking and I went upstairs to go to sleep.
Somebody follows you.
And
I mean, somebody overpowers you.
You know, I was pretty incapacitated.
Yes.
And, you know, then my friends come upstairs and they're banging on the door. They're like, what's going on? Open the door and get him out of there. And all of that, you know, was shocking. Or I should say, I think I, you know, was in shock when that happened the next morning. And it's like, what do we do? You know, what we did was go to the hospital, make sure that I was physically okay.
Yes.
And that was it.
You didn't legally pursue anything?
I didn't know what happened to me was rape. And that's something I recently read about unacknowledged rape and what that could do. Like I thought, well, was that a sexual assault? What was that? I didn't know what it was. And my friends at the time, I think they also didn't know what to do. And everyone kind of were like, well, we didn't want to call anyone and tell anybody because we were drinking and we weren't supposed to be drinking.
It's not like you're going to grab the phone and call your parents and say, last evening didn't go as planned, you know?
It was, you know, it was, I think for my friends, it was more they didn't want to tell anyone because they didn't want to get in trouble. For me, I didn't want to hurt my parents.
Parents have a picture of your life, your brother's life, their children. Every parent wishes their child grows up safe and happy. And it didn't take very long to show the safe part went out the window. So it's like we went down there thinking we were in control and we're grownups, as you said, 18 years old, as if that's very old, mature. You know, we know what we're doing. And then things turn around that quickly. So yeah, you're not calling up mom and dad. How do you explain it? You're not pulling the fire alarm yet. I understand.
You know, exactly that. I said, I thought to myself, how am I going to tell them this? They're going to be so upset. This is going to be so much for them. So in one breath, I knew what happened was wrong and I could have used support, but at the same time was telling myself, well, it really wasn't that bad. And it wasn't like what you think of, I also think this is, you know, a little over 20 years ago. We knew rape was, well, of course, if you're walking down the street and someone grabbed you, that's what it was. Or you knew if someone physically overpowered you, well, that's what it was. There wasn't a lot of education surrounding drinking and what is consent really. So a large part of me tried to minimize what happened and say, you're okay and your friends aren't acting like it's a big deal. So why are you going to act like it's a big deal? Mm-hmm. Which really leading it to down the road, I think that really impacted how I viewed things that happened later in my life. Yeah.
Did your parents to this day ever hear about that North Carolina trip? No.
No, I still
hold that back.
That's the one thing I've never told them because I think at this point I'm like, do I need to tell them? Like, is that, do they need to feel that? Do they need to, because I can only, imagine how, and especially now being a mother myself, how would my mom feel? She would be like, my daughter went through all of this alone and without support. And,
And you ask yourself, what good will come from that piece of information? And there really isn't any good that'll come from that piece of information. They don't need that in their memory. I understand.
So I came back and...
Did you come back immediately or do you finish the week?
I don't remember exactly where the week had happened. I feel like it happened in the middle / towards the end. So, and that was again, part of like, I was definitely in shock after the fact, but my friends went about doing, we're supposed to go to dinner. We're supposed to do this. We're supposed to do that. So that's what I did. And I kept telling myself, well, they're acting like it's not a big deal. So that's what I did. Then, we got home and again, no one talked to me about it. No one said, how are you doing? No one said, so I just didn't think anything of it until I tried to minimize it to myself and say, be okay.
Yeah, you tried to find a place to park it.
Yes. And
if you get to the point where it's like, well, if the whole, my own world, my friends, if they're not acting like it's the biggest thing that ever happened, it was just a mistake. And I guess I should now think about college or something else or the rest of the summer.
And, when I went to the hospital, they asked, do you have insurance? And I said, well, my parents, but I'm not going to use it. They're like, are you sure? And I said, yes. So they, my friend said, well, use my address. And when they send the bill, it'll come to my house. Which again, when you're in that state, you're not thinking about what is that going to look like and how much money is that going to be? Again, we're 18. We think we know so much. We don't know much at all. A couple weeks later, my friend gets a bill at her house for $1,000 for an ER visit.
$1,000. Oh my God. Yeah. 18 years old, $1,000. And this is
about 22 years ago. So...
1,000 was even more than today, and today it's a lot when you're 18. It's a fortune.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get $6,000 cash, give us each $3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com or wherever fine podcasts are found.
What am I, how am I going to pay for the, like, what am I going to do? You know, I was fortunate enough that, you know, I have a big, like, extended family. I got money for graduation from, you know, my family, and it felt wrong using that money to pay for this. And one thing that was very, again, goes back to the minimizing things. My friend said, like, her mother got the mail, and she found the bill.
Geez.
And she said, why is Jamie getting mail here? And my friend tells her what happened. Her response is, well, that's the stupid kind of shit that happens when people drink.
Oh, my God.
And I was so, it was like,
wow,
you know, knocking the wind out of me and further reinforce, like, what happened to you isn't a big deal. And, you know, now I know that that's outrageous and horrific. And again, but again, this is over 20 years ago. This is really ingrained in people that it's not, you know, oh, well, it's drunk and oh, it's. And that's the furthest thing from, it wasn't just a, like a, you know, hookup or something like that. It wasn't that at all.
But it was almost like you dented the car. And so, you know, you'd learn to live with it or get it fixed and just get on with it, get it buffed out. So what, you know, you made a mistake, you paid for it. What else is new? That was cold. I'm surprised that that woman said that. It's really disappointing.
And I don't know how much. You know, I don't know exactly, you know, what my friend told her or anything like that. But, you know, and I know that wouldn't be, again, my parents' response or anything like that. But my friends kind of acted that way. She said those things. So, again, it's just like, okay, well, I need to just be okay. So I finished the summer. This is towards the end of the summer anyway. And I went to, I left for college. And then, you know, it was the end of August. And September 11th happened.
Oh, that's right.
And life changed for everyone, you know, and I say that because it really did, you know, that what had happened to me, you know, it just obviously was nothing in comparison to what was going on in the world. And that became such a huge thing. So I just kind of, like I said, like I had to put it away and went about, you know, college, what I thought I was supposed to be doing. So, you know, doing well at school, being involved in activities, you know, and being in college, and I enjoyed being in college.
Were you on full alert anytime you went to a party from because of what happened?
You know, it was one of those, we talked to each other, to friends, and said, let's always look out for each other, let's not leave each other, that kind of thing. And yet still things happened to people. And I'm not when I was there, but like I had a friend who had something kind of similar happen. It's just, it was very prevalent. And I feel like it just was starting to get talked about. But again, it wasn't like we were in high school and they said, hey, when you go to college, these are things you should be concerned about. I feel like that's, and I hope that's more the case nowadays. But yeah, it's back there. It was always back there.
Did it make you moderate how much you drank? It's part of what I'm wondering.
Yes and no. You know, because you don't ever think, at least I never thought, right, that these things would happen. You're like, again, like, because, and I didn't say, oh, yes, you were raped when you were 18. That's what happened. I didn't, you know, acknowledge it. So it's this weird of like knowing something was wrong and knowing what happened but then not being able to really filter it into your life, how you're going about things, if that makes sense, at least for me.
I get it. So you make your way through college. You do the 4 years, you graduate.
Do the 4 years, graduate, know I'm going to go to law school, know I want to be a prosecutor. You know, I didn't really date in college, like at least date anyone, you know, exclusively, consistently. I didn't want to do that until the end of, like, I would say my senior year, I started dating someone. And this comes into the story because, you know, I graduate from college and I'm going to law school in another state. So several hours away from my family. And he actually decided to go up there too. And he wasn't right near me, but he was about a half an hour, 45 minutes like away. So when I first started law school, I was in this relationship. But when I got to law school, it wasn't, I don't know what I thought it was going to be, but it was harder than I thought it was going to be. You know, in high school, I did well in school. I had friends, I did activities, sports, all that. Same thing at college. When I got to law school, it was like you had everyone in your class who was at the top of their class, who was involved in activities, who did sports, like who went to, you know, so it was just a whole other level. There was also people who had professions and then came back to law school, who had families and came back to law school. So it's a very different dynamic.
Isn't law school the case where you will go through the semester without tests of any kind and then get slammed at the end of it?
It depends on the teachers, but there would be some classes where you didn't have anything and you just had a final, or you had like a midterm and a final. But yes, it's not, you know, it's different. Law school in general, they're teaching you how to think about things differently. And there was also, then there were some people who knew each other, who like had gone to college together or had friends of friends. So when I came in, I felt very alone.
I can picture that.
You know, I was anxious a lot, and it didn't come easily to me.
Not a super happy time. Just you and your books and the classes and some participation and more books and more reading.
Right. And I was dating this guy. That wasn't helpful at all. He didn't understand law school. He didn't understand the stress or anxiety, anything like that. And we ended up breaking up in like the middle of my first year in law school. Throughout this time, I met Adam in my class in law school. He was in my section. And we were friends throughout the fall semester when I was dating this other person. He seemed very nice. He seemed kind of dorky, like maybe he wasn't the most popular guy, but, you know, in college or high school. And we became friends. I knew he liked me after I had gotten out of this other relationship. And I was like, I don't want to start something else. I'm not ready for another relationship. But we spent so much time together and, you know, kind of happened or kind of wore me down, I would say. And we started dating that summer between my first and second year of law school. And he was, again, he, I thought, was nice. He got, obviously, what I was going through with law school. And, you know, we studied together or at the library, all that kind of stuff. And he also seemed to have, I thought, a genuine interest in my interests. You know, I really liked dancing, and he took me to see a show that I had wanted to see, or there was a concert that I really wanted to see. Like we did those things. So I thought this was just a normal relationship. And my second year in school, I started doing mock trial, which is kind of what it sounds like, fake trials in the courtroom. And you have to try out for the team, and it can be a big to do. And, you know, I did it and I did well. I finally felt like, okay, I found my footing in law school. Like I kind of fit in here, and he seemed to be proud of that, if you will. Like, oh, you know, she's good at this and that whole thing.
How did he, as a lawyer to be at that time, how did he perform, do you think? I mean, was he hanging in there like you? Was he enjoying it?
I think he was more comfortable with the atmosphere of, you know, the competition aspect of it. I think he liked that.
Okay.
So I think he didn't struggle as much as I did with the classes, mm-hmm, and things. So I think he thought highly of himself. And so he had certain things he wanted to do, to be on a journal, he was also did the mock trial and things like that. So he was doing well. It wasn't until, I would say, we were dating for probably like 7 or 8 months before anything that I knew was, you know, something. It was, you know, halfway through that year, and they have a ball every year for the law students. We joke and say it's like law school prom. You know, we went to it, people are drinking, we were drinking, and afterwards they block out rooms at a hotel so people don't drive. And we stayed there during this time. I lived with my brother when I was in law school up until this point, because he had lived up where I was going to school.
This is in the Northeast, right?
Correct.
Northeast of Philly, yes.
And he traveled a lot for work, and you know, mm-hmm. it made sense. I didn't know anybody. So we had lived together, and he actually went to this dance with a friend of mine, but they didn't have book a room. So I told them, like, you could stay in our room. Like, it's not a big deal. My boyfriend was very agitated by that, which I didn't know until that night. And he had wanted to be intimate that night. And we had friends in another room, like people were hanging out. That's what I wanted to do. And he got, you know, very bothered by that. You know, I don't even know like how it happened, but all of a sudden I'm trying to leave the room and he wouldn't let me. And he stood in front of me and kind of puffed out his chest and made himself big and would not let me pass. If I kind of tried to go to the right, he moved, left, he moved to like block me. And it got, I was scared. And I, you know, tried to push past him, eventually was able to get him out of the way, kind of like put my nails in his chest, like get out of the way. And I go out the door and I remember I had my dress was hanging up on a hanger. He picked up my dress and he threw it at me. There were people walking down the hallway at this time that we went to school with. And I was mortified. I grabbed my dress. I ran actually to the stairwell and I like waited because I was thinking he would think I went to the elevator or something. And I didn't know what was happening. I got my brother and my other friend and we walked to another hotel.
Totally left the place. Wow.
Cause it's just, I don't know what I really told them about what happened, but it was just, we need to go. They didn't have a room anyway. So we went to this other hotel and he proceeded to call me incessantly for a very long time. He was calling my friend. He was calling my brother. He just would not stop unless I like came out to talk to him. So I came out, I talked to him. He wanted me to leave with him. I was like, I'm not going anywhere with you. He left. He was angry. Fortunately, you know, that night's over. And then the next day it's like, what happened? I don't even know. He's calling me and he is upset. He is crying. He's apologetic. And he asks me to come over. And I did. I went to his house and he's in his room, has a belt like up where the curtains are hung in his bedroom.
There's a belt up there where like a belt a person would wear.
Yes. And I'm like, what?
And it's up there by itself. It's up there.
It's up there and he is in his bed crying, just so he was a wreck, saying, I'm sorry that I did this. I don't know what I was thinking. And he was saying he was going to kill himself. And I just, you know, part of me was like, come on, really? Like, could you? No, like you. And I just, you know, I was like, he couldn't possibly really be thinking that, right? But I wasn't going to take a chance. You know, I stayed there. I talked to him and,
of course,
you know, forgave him. So, you know, it was like, okay, you were drunk. Like, it's not a big deal. Nothing, again, minimize. Like, okay, nothing, you know, you didn't put your hands on me. Like, it's fine. So that was that. And things were good then. Went back to school. We're doing what we're doing. I thought things were good. You know, there were a couple of random things that happened that I feel like, looking back, I know weren't okay. And I want to bring up in case someone else is listening going, I know this isn't right, but is it really abuse? Because again, in my head, I was like, well, he didn't hit me. If he hit me, I would know this is wrong. Right. And then I would leave. Right. Mm-hmm. But he didn't do that. So I thought it was okay. But you know, we would have, again, we would go weeks and weeks where nothing would happen. We're going to school together. And I thought, you know, he's supportive and this is, you know, a good relationship. But there were times where, like, I remember one time we got in a fight at school and I wanted to leave. I go out to the parking lot and he follows me and he got behind my car and he wouldn't let me back out of the parking space. Went on for what felt like a very long time. He's angry and he's blocking me and he won't let me leave. And I was like, again, embarrassed. I'm looking around like, who's going to see us and think, what's wrong with them? What's going on? You know, eventually he moves and I go to my friend's house and it's the same thing happens. He's calling my phone incessantly. He won't stop calling. He's calling her. She's like, you need to stop. You need to leave her alone and it'll be fine, but just stop it. So he was a year younger than I was. And my friend, I had one, I would say, good friend in law school. She was a year older than I was. And she was always just like, you know, he's young. He's immature. She didn't understand this. And that's kind of what she would say. So that's kind of like, yeah, that's true. He's just young.
He's young and immature, but he's 21 or two or something.
So he was, I guess, 22 or 23 at that point. Yeah.
So he was a year younger than you, but the same year in law school.
Correct.
Okay.
That happened. And another thing that I, at the time, didn't think was that big of a deal, but, you know, at the moment I knew it was when we were driving, there would be times when we were driving and I'd ask him to slow down and that would really bother him for some reason. And I remember times or other times when we were having a disagreement and an argument, he would intentionally drive faster or more recklessly because it bothered me. And I didn't see it at the time. Again, I knew it wasn't right. And you're like, okay, he's upset. That's why he's doing it. You know, but looking back, he so clearly was doing it because it made me upset, because it made me scared. But, you know, we didn't have any other, you know, we finished like our 2L year.
I'm not hearing isolation techniques. Are there any, is any of that going on? Is he trying to trim down your friend network or anything?
I thought about this listening to the podcast and stuff. I feel like I was already isolated. I had moved away from my family to go to law school.
They weren't in the way as far as he would be concerned.
Right. And he actually, his family was nearby. They were about 30 minutes away from where we went to school. So we would go to his family's house. He had a big family. He had three siblings. There was always some kind of like family event. So we went to his family a lot. You know, I saw my family like on holidays or bigger things, but it's like, he didn't really have to try to do that because they were physically further away. And even my brother had a full-time job. Like, we didn't hang out all that much. So it wasn't like he had to really try. And then I had what I would say was like one good friend in law school. But other than her, he was my friend and he was my kind of my support system, if you will. So, which is goes right into what I was going to say happened that summer between our 2 and 3L year. That good friend of mine, she went home to work during the summer. So she was in another state. And my brother actually moved to another state some point during that year as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm now living in an apartment by myself and I'm working during the summer. My boyfriend is working, but he's the one I saw all the time. There was at some point during the summer, we were at his apartment. He was going to be going away for his job. We were in bed and again, he wanted to be intimate. I didn't. He got very angry. And I don't remember if he was drinking at all that night. Like if he did, maybe he had like a drink or two, but we were in bed and he kind of shoved me out of the bed. Just kind of like a quick, his bed was low to the ground and my side was close to the wall. So I kind of went out and down. And it was like, what was that? Like, I just didn't.
Was it kind of like, you don't want me, I don't want you. So therefore you get ejected, you think?
Yes, it was. I definitely think it was he felt rejected. Therefore he was going to do that. And he just kind of shoved me. I got out of the bed and I remember I was like, you know, whatever. Like I just grabbed my stuff, packed up my stuff. I'm like, I'm leaving. We exchanged like words as, I was walking out of the apartment, and as like I get to the threshold of the door, he shoved me again and he spit at me. And
that's a statement.
And again, I think that's this, you're in shock. You're like, what is happening right now? What's going on?
Who does that? Yeah.
And I was scared. And that was the first time I was, well, I should say the first, I was scared when everything happened in the hotel. But again, I was scared. And I was like, this is, I don't know. I got in my car and I'm like, what am I going to do? And I went and I like parked near the apartment where I used to live because it wasn't too far from where he lived. And I was like, well, what are you going to do? You're going to sit in your car all night? Like if someone sees you, what are they going to call the police or think? Or maybe he's going to think, oh, she went back to her old apartment. So then I drove to a parking lot that was in between his apartment and our school. And I like sat there for a little bit. And then I'm like, again, what are you going to do? You're going to sleep in your car all night? Because I was afraid to go back to my apartment because I lived alone.
Is he blowing up your phone in the meantime at all? Or is he quiet this time?
I think he's actually quiet this time. And I don't really remember, but I remember thinking like, again, what are you going to do? What if what people perceive as a threat is that like random scary person pulls over and, you know, does something to you, you know? So I'm like, oh, I can't sit here. Or what if the cops drive by? They're going to be like, why are you sitting here alone? So I remembered a friend of mine from high school had recently moved to a town 30 minutes away. And I called her and I said, can I come over? I had a fight with my boyfriend. She was like, yeah, of course. And I went to her house and I stayed there. Oh, now he was blowing up my phone when I was there. And I didn't tell her what happened. I just said it was a fight. But, you know, I didn't get much sleep at all that night. And then I was like, what am I going to do? And I was like, I have to go back to my apartment because I have a job that I have to get to. So I got back there, got ready for work, went to work, and he went away for that weekend. And that entire weekend, it was, I'm going to cheat on you. You're no good. All that kind of stuff.
He's threats, let's call them. I mean, they are basically threats, maybe with a lowercase t, not a capital T, but still threats.
And I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to call my, like, it's embarrassing. I was embarrassed by what happened. So I didn't want to call my friend and tell her because it's like, how do you justify that?
This is your boyfriend?
Yeah,
this is your boyfriend? You call this guy your boyfriend?
And I certainly wasn't going to call my parents and tell them that because, again, I thought this the same thing. They're going to be like, well, absolutely not. Like, you're...
Get out of there. What are you waiting for? Be watching for Jamie's story, part 2, the second and last part of a narrative that shows even the best and brightest can fall into the living nightmare of domestic violence. Thank you for listening to the When Dating Hurts podcast. We have been steadily moving up in podcast review rankings based on downloads in the relationships category. That means more and more listeners are getting the kind of advice that can improve lives for victims, survivors, and their families. If you feel we need to hear your story, do not hesitate to email me at BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. That's BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. Hi, it's Bill Mitchell. I'm proud to say the When Dating Hurts podcast is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. To learn more about Evergreen Podcasts or to check out other shows on the Evergreen Network, just visit evergreenpodcasts.com.